Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes on the Zero Point Show through BBS Radio. It is July 9th, 2011. And I'm coming to you from just south of Ottawa, Ontario. And my co-host, Jim Moffat, is from Toronto, Ontario. Welcome, Jim.
Hi, Chris. How are things?
Okay. I've just started working at my next book that I want to put out, which is my Zero Point Teachings book.
Oh.
Yeah, and actually have assembled that. Almost the whole thing is done, except for some of the final sections I'm going to have to complete. I'm going to have a final section, which is a tribute to Karen. And before that, I'm writing up my proposal for the worldwide criminal prosecution of the elites. One of my pet concepts. But otherwise, almost the whole book is done.
Wow.
Just from material. It's materials from my website. And most importantly, I'm including the four-part article series that I've been doing for the Journal of Esoteric Studies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so that whole article series will be in it. That's why I had been working at that part four of that, which was the concluding section of that article. Which I've submitted for them to review, but I haven't had it accepted yet or had the feedback. It's been a very valuable process each time, submitting it and having people's reactions and comments and then incorporating that into the article and refining it further. It's a very valuable process.
Yeah, well, with the journal, you get people who are already predisposed to considering its real significance and who have an interest in these areas and are much more receptive and can provide like a really informed commentary and feedback. Donna's an excellent editor and Donna Brown and she's chief editor
at the journal.
And she seemed to really, I think, really have a good grasp of the significance of your work. Like, I think she saw the value of it, like, in very important ways. So,
She did. She wrote that amazing review of God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine. And I was so impressed by it because at that point I still only had my book in the Sirlock binding in the old forms that I used to print them. And they weren't nearly as nicely presented as they are in the paperback editions. But she kind of saw through that and saw the substance of the book. Yeah, so.
I just have it right here. It's on the screen in front of me. She concludes by saying, while portions of this book are not easygoing, Holmes plunges the reader into the deep places of the occult and the new frontiers of science to come up with a lucid and provocative book. It unseals many of the secret doctrine mysteries as it weaves the seeming opposites of spirit and science into a new synthesis. It is a must read for those wishing to understand the complex and seemingly impenetrable world of Helena Blavatsky alongside the newest ideas of quantum theory. Holmes has created something of his own tour de force in God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine. His book is destined to serve as a guidebook for all those that follow, which is really nice. I mean, I think that's, you know, something she touches on there about unseals many of the secret doctrine mysteries. You have to kind of understand how difficult it is to understand the secret doctrine in and of itself. Never mind, just understand what she's saying and then relate it to ideas in modern physics and science is really, you know, it's not for the faint of heart. And as she says, the book is not easy going in places. I mean, it's
difficult. Yeah.
It's difficult. But,
yeah, my books are.
Yeah, but it's kind of like, you know, anything that's really valuable can't be terribly easy, you know. I mean, and parts of it are very accessible actually. So that's the other side of it is that you can read your books and get the gestalt of something very different. You might not be able to get all the details, but you can at least see that you're coming from an entirely different perspective on things. I mean, something as simple as contrasting that the head doctrine and the heart doctrine, which is enormously significant, but it's actually a very straightforward kind of explanation. I think most informed, intelligent readers can certainly grasp what you're arguing, and you know, the examples are pretty down to earth and concrete. When you get into some of the more difficult ideas in physics, it becomes a little more challenging. But it's like, you know, it's certainly there are parts of it that are accessible. And like she says, it's like it's something of your own tour de force, because it's a guidebook to like a different perspective. So it's a very good review.
Yeah,
I thought I just happened to have that on my screen too.
Oh yeah. It's also very interesting in that it's quite a unique contribution to the literature on the secret doctrine, in that it puts this concept of zero points kind of front and center in the presentation. Whereas I think if you read the secret doctrine, like that zero point concepts are in there, but it's kind of hidden amongst the mass of other materials. And it's really hard to, most people who study the secret doctrine don't come away from it with any understanding, I don't think, of what Blavatsky means by zero points and Leia centers and such. It's kind of strewn into the other material. And I don't think most theosophists have seen the significance of that. So I think that's quite a unique aspect to my work, is to bring out that teaching in the secret doctrine. And I have that quote that I often quote from Blavatsky, where she says, "Material points without extension are Leibniz's monads, and at the same time, the materials by which the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies." So, in a way, it's like a bizarre concept. It's saying that somehow human beings, as well as other living beings, because it applies to the cosmos and it applies to the sun and it applies to the galaxy, like different beings on different orders of scale. So the idea is that they have a zero-point center, and that the zero-point center, in a way, Blavatsky also calls that a Leia center, spelled L-A-Y-A, Leia center. And she sometimes spells it Layu center, L-A-Y-U. And so in their undifferentiated state, these Leia centers exist even before they differentiate. But then when they differentiate, a cosmos has like a first point of unfoldment. And it's so useful, I think, Jim, to think that, wow, our scientists today trace our whole universe back to a singular point. So, in a way, when you put it in that context, it's, well, what's more unlikely, that our universe would have emerged from a point, or that a human being might have something that within them that similarly emerged from a point source, like as above, so below? And really, I mean, it's, you know, a person would ordinarily, you could never conceive that the whole huge universe might have emerged from a point. So that's even more like seemingly impossible or ridiculous. People would dismiss it. So in a way, it's applying that same concept and taking up the things I pull out of the secret doctrine. You know, Blavatsky's references to how beings differentiate from a Leia center, and she tells in the stanzas of Zan how the universe is kind of founded on seven Leia centers, or seven zero-point centers. Like, sometimes it's just one Leia center, but then that differentiates into seven Leia centers. And it's similar to how in the human being, you can describe the first lay center is the heart center, but then from the heart center, you have the differentiation of seven chakras, and each of those chakras is described as having like a vortex, and there's a central point to each chakra. So we can think of a human being as having this kind of sevenfold lay centers related to the chakra system. And it all originates out of the heart. So Blavatsky's notion, you know, it reminds me of the illustrations of Alex Gray. Are you aware of him, Jim? I think I asked you this once before. He does pictures of, like, a human's being subtles and a subtle anatomy.
Yeah, no, I don't know him. You mentioned him before, yeah. We did talk. I remember we talked.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, I remember that too, yeah. Because I was telling you, he's the guy who said he transferred his consciousness to the moon.
Oh.
Remember him? And he was saying, and he had similar ideas about the moon to Gurdjieff.
Oh,
how
wow.
The moon feeds off the souls of men. He had seen that in, like, expanded states of consciousness, I think under the influence of LSD, but I'm not sure.
That'll help.
He was a very interesting interview. He was on Coast to Coast with George Norrie a couple years ago. But anyway, so I think that is unique about my book on the secret doctrine, is this focus on the zero point concept. And it's interesting because it's only in the last 20 years of physics that concept has emerged in modern physics. And yet we find the term zero point. It was back in Blavatsky's writing over, 130 years ago, almost 120 years ago. So in a way, she's the first one whose literature I've ever been aware of to use that term zero point. So it is, I think the book is really valuable in terms of the focus on the zero point and then relating it to more advanced concepts in physics. Because that book now, at the end, it gets into these very complex new ideas emerging in holographic physics about these little mini black holes could be information processors. And this idea emerging in physics, and I apply that whole framework of ideas to try to look at how a human being might operate similarly. Oh. It's a very interesting kind of parallel, Jim?
Yeah, well, that's the interesting thing, as like you say. It's ironic you should say, odd that you should say this about... but the single point in the universe emerging. I heard this at the beginning of this program on the CBC science show today, Quirks and Quarks, and they were asking the scientists to come up with what they considered the most mysterious unsolved question in science. And the first guy that spoke talked about, did the universe have a beginning and does it have an end? And he was talking about, you know, that we could trace everything back through our laws. And he said, you know, there is a question still remains to the Big Bang. He says, was there something before the Big Bang? But he says, really, like, you know, it's a little more complicated than that, because it's really that, like, space becomes, if you trace it back to this point, space becomes infinitely curved. And it's not that we arrive at the beginning, but all the equations break down, right? So
yeah.
It's a mathematical formalism that leads to a zero point, in the sense that all measurement collapses, so there's no meaning beyond that. And when he was talking about that, he's just talking about everything being, you know, condensed in everything in the universe is condensed into this infinitesimally small point. Is like, is it really any more miraculous to think of like a fertilized egg as, you know, coming out of some higher dimensional space and becoming a human being? It's not really any more miraculous than the fact that the whole universe came out of this point. You know, it's like, yeah. I always love that quote that from Voltaire, who was like sort of the arch skeptic, you know, and was against the church and religion and everything. But he talking about reincarnation, he said it's no more of a miracle to be born twice than it is to be born once, you know, and which I think is just like, that's great, eh? Like, I mean, it sort of turns the logic of it all. It's like, yeah, you know, when people talk about reincarnation, they, well, you know, it's impossible. But when you really think about it, like, birth is impossible too. Like, you know, how is it that some little material elements mix and then, you know, Einstein results, or, you know, George Bush, you know, like, I mean, it's like, it's quite amazing, like, that when you really, we think of all of our existence, like the old piece of graffiti on Henry Miller's bathroom, you know, don't look for miracles, you are the miracle. I mean,
oh, yeah, wow.
Yeah, yeah. Listen to this. This is interesting. I thought I was going to send this to you. This is from Mysticism and the New Physics by Michael Talbot, which is kind of a weird book in a lot of ways. But he's talking about the fundamental building blocks of matter and John Wheeler and his ideas. And he says there's no ultimate physical substance to matter. And then he's talking about the tantric theory of matter is similar to what modern science has arrived at. And he says, for example, the Hindu concept of nada and bindu, concepts of nada and bindu are identical to concepts of matter being both a wave and a particle. Translated roughly, nada means movement or vibration, so like the wave. When Brahma creates matter, nada is first produced, is the first produced movement in the ideating cosmic consciousness. Bindu literally means a point. According to Tantra, when matter is viewed as separate from consciousness, it can be made up of many bindu and physical objects appear to be extended in space. However, when matter is more accurately perceived as being projected by the consciousness, physical objects no longer possess many three-dimensional points in space. Everything collapses to one dimension, remarkably similar to the one-dimensionality the universe takes on in, as viewed in terms of Wheeler's quantum interconnectedness, and becomes a single-point bindu, or as André Padou, who I don't know who that is, some French guy, puts it, le point sans dimension, in other words, in the dimensionless point. So,
wow, that's interesting.
So everything is like, so and he's talking about, this is a teacher, Pratagatamananda, wrote that every object or process has to be studied nada-wise and bindu-wise, in other words, as a wave or a particle. So, like, that's interesting, too. Again, it's like this idea of, like, this single point as being the origin of the actual manifestation, the material manifestation of the ideating cosmic consciousness. So it's like these higher dimensional consciousness produces the matter of the physical realm, and it's like it's from this point source. So it's like that's very clearly similar to what Blavatsky's talking about. But like you say, it's when it's articulated in The Secret Doctrine, it's easy to read selections from her work and not see that. Like, I haven't read all The Secret Doctrine, but I've read excerpts from her work and commentaries on her work in the excerpts. And if I didn't know those things were in there, I wouldn't have grasped the, you know, because I knew your work, I was sort of alerted to them and could follow what she was saying. But it's not easy to kind of see what exactly she is saying. And then, and you've given talks to the Theosophical Society in California and New Zealand, so you'd be much more aware as to the level of understanding. But my understanding is that it's not in the Theosophical literature that people have grasped this at all.
No, well, I mean, I'd need to research that more to really make that judgment, but
yeah,
that's my impression, too, that it's not been picked up, like the zero-point concept. And
yeah, well, and you don't see it in any of the discussions of any of the work from a more of a mystical or esoteric perspective on consciousness. I definitely, I've never seen anybody relate that idea. And, I mean, it does exist in modern science of a point source singularity. Nobody relates that to the origins of human consciousness and like, how human beings could have a zero-point origin.
Yeah, to imagine that, as applied to a microcosm. Yeah, absolutely. That's what's so interesting about having this mystical perspective. Like, it's like when I read those articles that I quote and discuss on holographic physics, and it's all about how mini black hole processors in higher dimensional space, what they call anti-de Sitter space, that the activities of those processes could be rendered equivalent to the physics of superstrings and then particle theories. And so these concepts have emerged in modern physics, but when they talk about it, they don't really explain how it might apply, like what it would apply to. They have the concepts of it, but when you have a mystical perspective, you can take the whole framework of ideas they present and apply it, or at least to consider it in regards to a human being. In a way, to have a mystical perspective, and then it's like what you're saying about, you know, we imagine the universe emerging from a first point, but no one talks about, well, could there be like a first point of supernal lux, which is the origin of consciousness? You know, we don't think on that level. So,
yeah, and then the other side of it too is that I'm just looking at the concluding remarks in your article, is that the other side of it, and this is, this is just strengthens, I think, the evidence for this position, is like what happens at death with the withdrawal into the point. Like that's very, very interesting, because there we have a lot of evidence from the near death experience literature, which is entirely consistent with that explanation. And nobody at all seems to have that perspective, because everybody talks about the mystery of the near death experience is sort of, broadly speaking, I mean, is that consciousness appears to be manifest without independently of the continued physiological processes of the body and the brain. So your heart stops, and people have flatline EEGs, which indicate no cortical activity, and yet people have experiences of themselves, and they experience themselves in terms of certain protocols, like the well-known traveling down the tunnel and then being greeted by beings of light and seeing dead relatives or people that they knew who have previously died, and often having this experience of great peace and of this experiencing this light, light which is an intelligence, and there are a variety of aspects of that experience. Everybody talks about that, and everybody talks about the anomaly and the enigma and the mystery of the fact that the brain, for all intents and purposes, is dead, and the heart has stopped, and yet people continue to exist. So and have consciousness of themselves, but nobody ever talks about it in terms of the dynamics of the heart.
Yeah,
and nobody ever relates this idea to the idea that's within the Dalai Lama's and the Tibetan Buddhist explanation of the withdrawal to the heart. And it's like that's how this perspective is entirely consistent with what happens, is that people have these experiences of the life review, where everything passes in front of them in a matter of seconds, but they have complete knowledge, often not only of themselves, but as not only their own experiences, but also the effects that their experiences had on other people. Like they have this kind of higher dimensional knowledge of their own personal history and how it's affected other people. And that's very interesting in terms of like the idea of like that this is withdrawal into this mini black hole, mini white hole of the computer. It's at least it provides a model which would suggest what the dynamics are. And like I say, I don't know of anybody who's actually written about the near death experience who's actually ever dealt with it in terms of the heart.
Yeah, no, I've never seen mention of it either. How people don't even talk about consciousness and the heart.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Let alone kind of what happens to consciousness at death.
Yeah,
I'm going to just go back for a second, because you mentioned something that I'll just elaborate on briefly too for the audience. Because Jim mentioned, like, according to the Dalai Lama, the first part to grow in the human being the human being is said to emerge from a first point, and that grows into what becomes the heart. And that's the original Leia center. And from there, the energies are distributed through three channels called the Ida, the Pingala, and the Shashumna. And it's distributed through the system of seven chakras. And this is very significant because it follows the formula that Jim and I often discuss of how God is first one, then three, then seven. And this is an example of that. So the idea is the original first point is within the heart, and then that's divided by the three channels into a system of seven chakras. So the whole idea is that there's this inner circulation of light. Okay, so then the Dalai Lama, so consciousness emerges from the heart, and then it's spread through the channels and through the chakra system, and there are knots formed and in the different chakras, and that captures that energy into that chakra. But then as death approaches, what happens is the vitality is withdrawn from the extremities, like from the hands and the feet, and all the energies gather back into the side channels, and they then come down and they resolve back into the central channel. And as the soul leaves the body, all the energies gather again to the heart. So that's what the Dalai Lama explains happens at death. It's like all the vitality is like sucked into this, what I would call a black hole kind of within the heart. And as that happens, that's when I'm saying this, the heart could function as like a quantum computer. And similarly to a black hole, and as the consciousness withdraws into the heart, then it could illuminate the whole patterns of your life, as though your whole life is still there in the kind of akasha or in the ethers. So when your heart draws into this deep dimension of yourself, you have access to all that information of your life, or even beyond that, as Jim described, like seeing the implications of your actions for other people. And it's an amazing concept. And like you say, Jim, I've never heard anybody else even offer any kind of suggestion how such a thing might be possible. So this concept of... I want to just read one other quote, too. This, I think, is funny. This is from the... it's a heavy metal band called Papa Roach, and they have a song. It's called Between Angels and Insects, and I think it's a very appropriate title because man kind of is between an angel and a cockroach, somewhere on that scale. But anyway, in this song, this is like just a musical poet of the heart in a way. And this is some of the words to this song. And I'll have to skip one word. He says the famous F word. So but this is what the song sings. Tell them what you heard. It's about a revolution in your heart and in your mind. Because everything is nothing, and emptiness is in everything. This reality is just a effed up dream. With the flesh and the blood that you call your soul, flip it inside out, it's a big black hole. It's so profound. But in a way, that's kind of what Blavatsky's saying. Like as the... we can imagine as in an infant who's conceived that consciousness emerges, the sons, Blavatsky says, expand and contract through their own hearts and selves. So when consciousness is coming into a growing fetus, it emerges out from the heart and distributed through the body. And then eventually when life or death draws, well, then all that energy gathers back into the heart again. So we can imagine the first point, the alpha point, is a white hole, because that signifies the emergence of this radiant energy and intelligence. Whereas when death arrives, then consciousness is withdrawn into the omega point, which is like a black hole. So we could think of zero-point centers. They could appear as both white holes and black holes. And they would appear both at different periods in their cycles. So I think that's really interesting too, Jim, to think of white holes and black holes.
And also, like, you know, this idea that this is really, I didn't know this until a couple of years ago, but the near-death experience was the idea of, like, I knew about people having past life reviews, and this happens very quickly. And people talk about this sometimes when people are in a have a near-death experience, like a car accident or they're drowning or something, their whole life will flash in front of them. You know, people know that expression. That's a very old expression, but I'd never heard anybody talk about this idea that not only did they experience what they experienced, but they experienced what other people experienced. And that sort of lends the eye to the only way to explain that I can see is, like, somehow if there's if there are interference patterns which are creating the holographic information systems that store what happens to us, somehow there must be an interaction with other holograms that are storing other people's information, and there's some sort of, you know, some sort of integration of those holograms. That information is available somehow, and I think that, again, like, that's, you know, that would be consistent with this idea of that you have this, all of this withdrawal of this into this tiny space, and then passage into this other dimension, where all of a sudden all of this information is available simultaneously. So again, it's like, roughly speaking, I think the idea is that in different dimensions, consciousness operates at different frequencies. So in a higher dimension, you'd have a higher vibrational rate, and information would be processed much more quickly, and you know, you could have this passage of your entire life in front of you in, like, what we would term our time would be seconds, you know, because how else would it be possible? Because people have very detailed life reviews, like, and again, like, that's interesting too, is that they have these detailed life reviews. It's like, I can't remember what I did yesterday afternoon in detail, let alone have my whole life passed. So what's happening there? Like, I mean, it everything about this kind of, like, and since the brain is dead, and since the physical body is dead, like, the whole idea that our mind is somehow produced by the physiological processes in the brain and is stored in the brain has to be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's the king size revelation that's involved in that, is that somehow this is all wrong. Like, you know,
yeah, the implication of near death experiences is that consciousness and mind were never being produced by the brain.
Yeah, and that's
not exclusively. I mean, they can contribute to our normal experience of consciousness, but it's not being produced. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, it's, you know, you have to have a brain, but it's to be conscious, but it's not being produced there. It's part of the transducer. It's part of the processing of it is, you know, all these different processes in the all these structures in the brain do things and process different aspects of information and perform various functional activities in the physical body. But that's not to say that the experience of consciousness is being produced by the brain's activity, or that life itself is totally dependent upon the function of the physical heart. Like, there's another dimension to all this. There's a higher dimensional aspect to it, to life and consciousness.
Yeah. And when we talk about the heart, we're saying that there is a higher dimensional nature to the heart, because it's not just the heart, a mass of soft muscle tissue, but we're kind of saying there's a psychical level to the heart, a spiritual level, and then ultimately a divine source emanation kind of connected. So there's like this higher dimensional physics to the heart.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful concept of human beings. Like, you know, like I personally in my life, I don't feel that I absolutely know it's true, but it fits with everything I do know, and it explains everything I do know, plus things that are inexplicable in other ways.
Yeah.
So to me, it's like the most feasible working hypothesis. It makes sense in a way that the whole Western psychology doesn't.
Yeah.
Like assuming that the brain produces consciousness, but no one can define what consciousness is or where it's produced or what it is or anything. At least this is a model of it.
I guess I do believe it because, I mean, as you say, like, I can't say for 100% for sure, but I mean, what convinces me that it is true is that it recurs in so many different esoteric teachings that I don't think they could be this consistently wrong in all these different traditions, you know, and it's not,
mm-hmm.
the modern perspective is like, oh, it's like it's poetry, it's supposed to be a metaphor, or it's like it's talking about things that you know, that people are magnifying aspects of human existence to fill them with an importance that they don't possess. It's like, I remember I saw this guy one time on television, I don't think I've ever told you this, he's a cardiologist, and he says, you know, people talk about the heart as being the seat of the soul. He says, but, you know, it's really just a pump. I'm thinking, well, you know, if you look at it as a pump, and you know, as a cardiologist, your job is to treat it as like to build a better pump, you know, then it is a pump. Like, I mean, yeah, on a certain level, that's true. But the second part of it is like the seat of the soul. It's like, well, you know, you're talking a different language, and you're not really trying to see things in their full depth. You're talking about things in a very superficial way. And I guess, as they say, if it was in one or two esoteric traditions where people talked about consciousness as being located in the heart and of this infinitesimally small point in the heart from which the life force originates, and the idea of the light of consciousness illuminating the mind and the brain, if that was sort of in one tradition or two traditions or three traditions, I might maintain some skepticism about it, but it's like it's in so many traditions that I just don't think that many people were wrong about something. I think it's like I take it as a fact, you know. And even if you just take it as a way of trying to question what we know and what we don't know, when you have that perspective, what it reveals over and over again is how people say things about the brain and the mind, and you know, draw this equivalency between the brain and the mind, which is just not substantiated. Like, you know, I often feel like saying to people, like when I hear people say things about their brain and that this is like, you realize that there's absolutely no scientific evidence for that proposition, don't you? That your mind is being produced by your brain.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like it's so ingrained, you know, and the one that really is, it just flat out irritates me because now it's in the popular press all the time. It's like I saw this thing, the headline in the sports section the other day, that this girl was wired for competition. I'm thinking, no, she's not. Nobody's wired for anything, you know. My television set is wired to transmit signals, you know, and my computer is wired to process information. But a human being is not a computer, is not a television set, it's not a thing of any sort. It's a dynamic organism, and it's not a piece of machinery. It computes and it processes information. There's no question about that. And, you know, those metaphors, like, you know, are fine as long as they're understood as metaphors. But people talk about it as if, like, you know, our brains are wired. Well, our brains aren't even wired. You know, everything in your body is breaking down and being replaced. Like, every physical aspect of your body is turning over. That's not happening to your computer. You know, the computer that you bought before is the computer that you have now. Like, it's bits. You know, its physical constituents, you know, prevail, and they're not being replaced. But human beings are dynamic, organic systems, and again, like when you realize that, then you're confronted by this conundrum as to how is it that the body changes its physical constituents and yet maintains its form, maintains the history of its form, and also seems to have some sort of inherent
time limit to its functioning so that there will be changes over time. Like there's a, like a program for to use that metaphor. Like, but it's so incredibly complex that it's way, way beyond. Like, I mean, when I hear those metaphors being used, I just think like they're moronic because they're taking us farther away from the real mysteries of everything, and they're denying the real mystery of it all. It's like, how is this possible? And what I would say is that it points more and more to inevitably is the need to understand that there are fields of information on a subtler level that are somehow organizing everything that happens on the material plane. Like I just think it leads to the inevitable conclusion that just as our consciousness has different levels of subtleness to it, I think our physical bodies do too. Like I just think that's like given, you know. But and I say it's like we're not pieces of machinery at all. In fact, like precisely the opposite, you know.
It's interesting what you say about how people make these analogies, but then kind of overextend those analogies. Like, they used to think, oh, man is like a machine.
Yeah.
Like during the industrial era, you know, that man is like a machine, and that would be our analogy, or a robot. Like, they think that robots are going to be able to have consciousness.
Yeah.
It's so funny when I hear these people in AI, like artificial intelligence, thinking that their robotic things have consciousness somehow because they've got these information processes going on, that's somehow is consciousness.
Yeah.
Which is absurd from our point of view. I think one term that I always liked is Swami Prabhupada.
He says
life comes from life.
Absolutely.
And that there's a living entity in the human body, like that inhabits the material body. I think that's really important. Like that is definitely what mystical teaching suggests, that there's some living entity that inhabits the body, but which is separate from the body. And it brings up very interesting questions. Like, I hear a lot of people, the significance they attach to the DNA.
Sorry? What?
Oh, we got some background noise a bit. Were you hearing that?
No, I didn't hear that.
Oh, okay. I was. Anyway. But the role of DNA, like, one thing Blavatsky says, and I don't understand these issues, but she says that the lunar tritis formed the material body, whereas the solar tritis, they fashioned the inner man or woman. Now, what pritis, P-R-I-T-I-S, means intelligences. So she's saying there's seven lunar intelligences and that they fashion the material body. Okay. And then there are solar, because in a way we come from the sun, in a way. The inner man, like Gurdjieff, would connect the inner eye with the sun, which is the spiritual world, or to the divine world, the starry world behind that. So in a way, the idea is the inner being, the living entity, comes down. It's associated with the sun and solar intelligence. Now, what is DNA? Like, in my view, DNA is more a mechanism fashioned by the lunar pritis. It doesn't give the constitution of the inner human being. That's how, like, you see some people think that, we got to transform our DNA and that all our potential is given in our DNA. And I don't see that. I see the DNA as some part of the mechanism for the creation of the material body, but I think the inner being is quite separate from the DNA. And I think there's a lot of wrong focus on that in New Age thinking. But it's a question I'm still trying to understand. But it goes back to what you were saying, Jim, about there being fields that underlie the material body and help direct like the flow, material and energetic processes in the body. And I think a useful analogy is the idea of sprinkling iron filings on a piece of paper. And if you have a horseshoe magnet underneath the paper, then all those iron filings will line up in a certain way because there's an underlying field. But if you're looking from above, all you see is the iron particles line up. You don't see the field, but the field is what forms those particles into the form that they need. It's the template for the field. So I think, Jim, that it all brings us back to this idea that there are underlying fields that pervade the material body, and the intelligence and organizing principles are within these subtle dimensions.
Yeah, and I think with the concept of fields is that I was trying to think of his name, Harold Saxton Burr at Yale University did, he called them L fields, life fields. This is research that was done in the 1930s, and he, he claimed to that these life fields, that he could measure them around various plants and trees, and that his hypothesis is exactly that, and that was the analogy I always used about the magnet and the iron filings. It's interesting because in about DNA, and I have to read it again because I didn't actually totally understand what he was saying, but in Pim van Lommel's book, he's the Dutch cardiologist that wrote Consciousness Beyond Life, he talks about DNA as a source of information for each cell, but he's kind of questioning the whole understanding of DNA as like, and also like the possibility, the possible functions of what junk DNA is. Because, like most
yes.
DNA, we don't really understand what its purpose is. That's the term is used as junk, but we don't really understand it. So he has some interesting, material in that, but I just wanted to hear something I just came across when I was looking for this on what he said about junk DNA. He's talking about the heart. He's talking about an electrocardiogram which shows the heart's electrical activity. And he says, he's talking about the complexity of the body. He says, presumably all of the body's quintillion cells are interconnected via the heart's rhythmically changing electromagnetic field. Also, the registration of the brain's electrical activity, the EEG, reveals the heart's electrical activity. It is possible that self-organization enables the heart, with its intensive electromagnetic fields with coherent patterns, to create reception potential, an interface for certain aspects of our consciousness, and to transmit this information via its electromagnetic fields to the body as a whole.
However, is amazing. What excellent material.
Yeah, see, and then he says, however, this supposition requires a great deal of additional research. So I sort of botched the reading of that quote, but what he's saying is that he's pointing to exactly what you're arguing in your work is like, because the heart has this fantastically strong electromagnetic field, which is 5,000 times that, which comes from the brain. He's saying that even in the EEG activity in your brain, you're actually registering part of the heart's activity. And
that's fascinating. Yeah, it's embedded even in underlying frequency in the brain activity.
Yeah. This guy's a cardiologist too. Eh?
Yeah.
So, I thought you have to read this book, Chris. You'll really love it. It's very, very interesting. And he says that his argument is that he talks about non-local consciousness. He says that consciousness is not located in the brain. Information is not per se stored locally, but it's non-local. He's so open to kind of. I think he would really find your book's very interesting. I think he would really, really be interested in it because he's so open. His position, he says, I don't know, but he's leading to all these, to a position which is entirely consistent with what you're arguing. So, and I think he'd be very interested in some of the material from the mystical and esoteric literature.
Yeah, I think he would be shocked.
Yeah, I think he would.
Really, too. There's this whole other literature having this view. Because my book kind of brings that together. That's kind of what's shocking a little bit about the heart doctrine. Is you start reading these quotes from the Kabbalists and esoteric Judaism and Sufism and the Dalai Lama and Blavatsky, all these people. Well, that's fascinating. I look forward. Is that the book that you had a copy for me sometime?
I bought a copy for you. Yeah.
If you can mail that off, I would really like to review that, and then I'll send him a complimentary copy of my book. I'd love to have some other additional professional commentary on my work.
Yeah.
It's amazing sometimes how much it's like working in a vacuum. I don't see other people very much influenced or picking up on things I say, like other consciousness researchers or such. I don't see that very much.
Yeah, I think there are a few people out there who are come from a more traditional training, like Mariel Beauregard, the neurologist in Montreal, who is very open to and proclaims himself not to be a materialist and to the spiritual. He wrote the book called The Spiritual Brain. And there are a few people who I think really have come with an open mind to these questions and realize the anomalies and the enigmas within the existing research are really point to there's something fundamentally wrong with this whole perspective that that consciousness is generated by the brain. Again, it's I don't want to sort of overdo this, but when you look at in the heart doctrine, and I've said this before on the show, but when you begin to survey all of the different esoteric and mystical texts, and I remember earlier versions of your book where there were so many quotes from so many different people essentially articulating the same point of view that I actually told you at point, enough, there's too many but they're there and they exist. As I say, how could people, over and over again be saying this? And yet it has what impact has it had on modern thought? Virtually none.
No, because there's no recognition in modern thought even of this as a possible other viewpoint. They don't even get that far. It's not that they recognize, in some traditions it's said that human self-existence originates out of the depths of the heart. No one ever says that. They just assume the head doctrine .
And as you said, this has been an ongoing criticism, but again, it's like you said, even the so-called New Age teachings, they all sort of jumped on this whole idea of the split brain
and the
two sides of the brain, and they've sort of married traditional teachings to these things, but they don't seem to be aware that there's a challenge, that there's absolutely no recognition of the head doctrine, that this could be completely wrong, and they seem to have been caught up in this left brain right business, right brain business. And again, neither of us are arguing that this isn't legitimate research and that there aren't differences in the size of the brain. There clearly are, but people have so grossly overstated the importance of those distinctions, and to the detriment of really acknowledging the more fundamental mystery first of all, nobody can really prove or substantiate the idea that consciousness emerges from the brain. It's just, Stanislav Grof says, it's one of the great epistemological assumptions of modern thinking. And, people will say, Carl Sagan says in Cosmos, on page 380 or whatever it is, that the elegant architecture of consciousness is created by the activities of the cerebral cortex. But nice poetic description, but,
Oh, is that the actual wording? I don't remember that.
He has that phrase about an elegant architecture of consciousness, and he relates to the activities of that. And it's very poetic, but it's bullshit, it may even actually be true, but I don't think it is. But there's no scientific evidence for it. Show me the study that has documented that. Show me the study that even suggests that. When you start, in your books, you talk about when you review the perspectives in modern science on the generation of consciousness. Different people have proposed different theories about what parts of the brain would be it. You know, it's like some people say it's like the
The reticular activating system.
Well,
some people and the
I'm trying to think of what's his name? Jeez, now
Crick?
I'm blanking out. Well, Crick says it's like his thing is specifically. He talks about the visual cortex, but I'm trying to think of the guy that not Sherrington, but the other guy who's not even a materialist, but he talks about some cortical structures that and says it's this layer of neurons. But whatever, nobody can really document it because there is no literature. It sort of goes back. It's like we were talking about metaphors, and when at the beginning of my book, I talk about the problem of God's contracting universe. I quote Theodore Rozak, where he talks about that the beginning of the scientific revolution, there were all sorts of things that were assumed that nobody had ever seen. Like nobody had ever seen a machine falling into existence accidentally through a random process, they say. Like the universe is supposed to be a machine that had evolved randomly through these processes. But nobody had ever actually seen that, and nobody had ever actually seen an atom. And it was like these are all things that people assumed. And they became part of the assumptive framework, and everything was built on that. But like, there's no observational data for that. Well, there's no observational data. There's no study that even argues convincingly that consciousness is produced by the brain. There just isn't. I mean, and I think most people would be quite shocked to know that. Like, you'd probably get an argument from some neurologist is like, oh, there is, but there isn't. It's very peculiar, and. I mean, again, it's like when people talk about the Big Bang. Well, there's no evidence that this happened randomly. People just say it happened randomly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like by definition, there was nobody to observe it. So nobody knows, like, really. Unless there's a God, and God might know. But I mean, other than that, no human being was there. It's like, there's so many things like that in science that are so funny. Like people will say, "Well, there's no data to support your position," but there's no data to support sort of the fundamental assumptions that underlie most of modern science. Like fundamental ideas, like that life is the result of accidental random processes, or that consciousness is produced by the brain, or that the universe spontaneously occurred because of a random fluctuation in the quantum vacuum. All may be true, but there's no evidence for it. So
no, they're assumptions, exactly.
Yeah.
And then because science has made so many advances in areas of material application, people then think that kind of validates the metaphysical assumptions underlying that research. But really, you can take the evidences of science, and you can separate from them from that kind of metaphysical bias and assumptions, and interpret them in a different way.
Exactly.
I want to go back a couple, two things that passed by that I wanted to touch on that you mentioned. One was you mentioned about, I've heard it was 95% of DNA is junk DNA.
Yeah, it is.
And it's an astonishing figure, which really makes one understand that, I mean, we don't really understand how this works, and they don't really understand how you go from DNA to produce the morphology of the body, what Sheldrake calls the problem of morphology.
Yeah.
Like, how do you go from having all these little separate cells, each of which is a little microcosm, into itself? Where does the larger field structure derive from, which then guides the formation of the proteins and the generation of the body tissues and everything? So people are completely unable to do that. They can't specify where that type of control comes from. So there is huge enigmas in science regarding DNA. And it is an interesting question. Like, what I'm trying to stress is that I think we're jumping the gun a bit, thinking that, you know, there's spiritual DNA and that the DNA in our body gives us our spiritual self. I don't see that. I see the DNA is responsible for the formation of the material body, but I don't think it gives you the higher dimensional structure of your inner self. And it's interesting, just to relate it to, people often say in the Bible, it says like, well, God created the fish and God created the animals. But if you actually read the Bible, it doesn't say that. It doesn't say God created the animals and fish. What it says is God said, let the earth bring forth. That's what it says. So it's like God kind of gives it to what Blavatsky would call like pritis or intelligences in nature. So God says, and God also says, let the waters bring forth,
yeah,
you know, fish and creatures of the sea. The waters bring it forth, and the land brings forth. That's what it says in the Bible. So it's not Mr. God who's kind of creating these things in their finished form. See, I think that that's a fundamental misunderstanding people have about, like, the book of Genesis, what it actually says. Because if you read, take the language literally, it appears to me that God ascribes the formation of material bodies to, like, the earth and the waters and such.
Yeah, very good point. Oh, by the way, it was the person I was trying to think of was Eccles, and he talks about the supplementary motor area of the cortex as being a possible site of. I knew. I was kept getting interference with SA. I thought it was. I knew it was SA, but it's actually SMA, and I was thinking of the SA node in the heart. And I was thinking, no, that's it. But anyway, it was Eccles that, even though he kind of, Eccles is not a materialist, so.
No.
Yeah. He sees consciousness and mind as being something that's not simply reducible to the brain's functions and activities. So, but yeah, that's a very interesting point, though, about what the Bible actually, what Genesis actually says. That's very different from saying, you know, I mean, also too, you know, that you could read that esoterically, like you say, let the waters bring forth, like the water is an esoteric. Interpretations of the Bible is wisdom. It's like it's intelligence, eh? So it's like, I mean, you could actually read it metaphorically too. But I mean, even read literally, like the waters and the land. It's like, yeah, like that's not God sitting in a factory, sort of producing fishes and birds and, you know, animals.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, it's like God creates the physical realms, and then the processes that are involved in those physical realms, you know. I mean, and that's where evolution...
They bring forth.
Yeah, they bring forth, which is to evolve.
There's something else.
Something else,
Well, there was one other thing I'd wanted to go back to a little bit. You were talking about how in modern science, like they trace the universe back to a singularity, and at a singularity, the curvature of space-time becomes infinite, and energy becomes infinite, and everything kind of collapses to infinite. And most scientists kind of say, well, you know, then it just everything is absorbed into infinity, so you can't say what happened, what there was before the beginning, because the beginning is the beginning of time, so you can't ask what's before that.
Right.
And it's fascinating to hear that's the attitude of many modern scientists, because when you study Blavatsky, what you realize is, oh, well, Blavatsky is saying what does exist before the beginning. Because what she is saying is that there's a seven-skinned eternal parent space, which is we'd call hyperspace, seven-dimensional hyperspace, and then she says there's this ceaseless breath or activity in hyperspace, and the ceaseless breath represents the Father principle. And when creation happens, the ceaseless breath gives rise to seven variants, which are the seven luminous suns. So the ceaseless breath gives birth to seven luminous suns, which are these, like, divine intelligences. But anyway, so It's interesting how, in Blavatsky's view, she is saying, no, you can ask what came before the beginning. And it's also very interesting because if you ask what came before the beginning, and then I say, well, seven-dimensional hyperspace, and then when creation occurs, like Blavatsky says, seven inside, seven outside. So when the worlds are created out of hyperspace, because it's sevenfold inside, it manifests a sevenfold nature on the outside, which makes perfect sense. It's like the conditions of existence are pre-existent in non-existence, which is a profound concept. That's kind of what the secret doctrine is saying, that the patterns of existence are pre-existent in non-existence before they're made manifest.
Isn't that kind of in keeping with what John Wheeler says about that everything is kind of given by the geometry of existence? Like everything is kind of, it's very Platonic, right? It's sort of like that there's these mm-hmm. higher dimensional ideals and that they're manifest. I mean, I was reading like Talbot on Wheeler, and that's sort of what I grasped that he was saying in a way, was that everything that we see in the manifest external world is sort of inherently given by the structure of some like ultimate reality that we can't observe. I may be sort of misinterpreting, but I thought that's what he was saying. And he referred to it in terms of the geometry, but of space. But I'm thinking that's entirely consistent with what Blavatsky's saying, really. And also, like what you're saying is very interesting because. And like in the fourth way, or in Search of the Miraculous, when Gurdjieff talks about the different cosmoses, the seven cosmoses, and he talks about the relation of one cosmos to another as being like of zero to infinity, and then he has Usmensky, who had written this book on the higher dimensions, and to expound on it, and it's like basically what they're describing is like the great chain of being, and Gurdjieff's terms, the ray of creation. But what they're saying is that the relation of a cosmos to the one above it and the one below it is like of zero to infinity. So it's like you have this zero point, which is this point where all measurement and quantification ceases to have any meaning, so you pass into this other dimension, right? So that these dimensions are sort of mathematically related as zero to infinity. And really, like, that again is like if we take the material plane that we live in, it's like the subtle dimensions are like that. Like they're beyond the our measurements, but that doesn't mean that they don't exist. They're just on a whole different level of vibration and frequency, and in a way, like it's the same thing. Like we were talking about the physical body, or you talk about the material plane in terms of physics, is that as long as you maintain that everything is just what you can measure, then you can't pass into these other dimensions. But in a way, it's kind of like people have recognized in terms of physics, they've certainly recognized that, well, we have to hypothesize something beyond it because clearly there is. And I think that's actually mm-hmm. true, too, of the physical body and of consciousness. That's the problem. Everything is in the flat land of the same level. And it's a failure to recognize that there are these higher dimensions which are informing and which are being stepped down and manifesting in the material plane, which is sort of like the limitation of contemporary knowledge, and that's sort of the great failing of it. It's like, yeah, we have precise information, but it's information on one level, and we have to kind of go beyond that to get a more comprehensive and complete picture of what's actually happening. Like we're, like in Bohm's terms, you know, we're taking the secondary phenomena as being primary, when in fact they're projections of these higher dimensional realities, and the principles that organize on these different levels are quite different.
Yeah.
And again, like Blavatsky, as you say, Blavatsky actually says, well, no, you know, I can tell you what happened. You know, I can tell you what existed before the beginning. Like, you know, it's like, and you can't get that without, like, a different level of consciousness. But people who have experienced these higher states of cosmic consciousness and realization do have, like, these explanations as to what is the fundamental reality is. Again, and just to get back to that comment you made earlier, I think that's really very profound. It's like life comes from life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Life isn't. It was never a product of material organization. No.
Yeah. And dumb non-sentient matter doesn't produce life. Life comes from life. You know.
Yeah.
Quite logical, really. I mean, it's actually more logical and rational than the accepted perspective, really.
Yeah, but both are legitimate scientific hypotheses. I mean, it's a legitimate hypothesis to argue that non-sentient matter gives birth to life and inner sentience. It's a legitimate hypothesis, but it's also a legitimate hypothesis to say, no, life comes from life. So to find the origin or source of life, you have to consider the subtle underlying dimensions, dimensionality to things.
And, of course, it also calls into question the idea that, is there any such thing as non-sentient matter? In a way, that's... It sort of opens that question again. It's like, you can understand it that way, but is that actually a comprehensive and coherent perspective on it? I mean, in a way, the evidence more and more suggests that it's not.
Yeah, and mysticism definitely suggests it's not,
because
there's one, as Blavatsky says in The Secret Doctrine, there's one omniscience which thrills throughout every finite point of the universe. So there's kind of intelligences and fields are underlying and sustaining everything. So there is no non-sentient matter. That's just an illusion.
Yeah, like Gurdjieff would say that, but even like some scientists have speculated like that even photons possess some sort of level of consciousness, you know, which I actually, it's like... Big question.
There's such mysteries in science.
Yeah,
it's interesting because they all the mysteries of science, to me, they kind of all lead to a mystical perspective.
Yeah.
Like, is the greatest mystery of modern science is what is the origin of human consciousness?
Yeah.
And if you pursue that question, it kind of leaves you, it's not answered within the Western tradition, but then within the mystical tradition is a whole alternative viewpoint and argument. It's so unfortunate that these types of influences and teachings have been so neglected in science and educational system, and they've, in a way... bifurcated like religion and science, like pose them as opposites, whereas I think our work kind of belies that. We're saying we need to take a scientific attitude towards mystical teachings to try to assess what is being said in them objectively. So we need to take scientific attitude towards mysticism, and then once you understand mysticism, there's concepts from mysticism, like I would say, for instance, the laws of 3 and 7, that you can apply to the interpretation of data in the material sciences. So it's a two-way process. You can take a mystical perspective and apply it to understanding the findings of science. And I think both of those are very important. I mean, that's why, it's often people say, oh, Zero Point, it's an institute for mystical and spiritual science. Aren't those things the opposite?
Yeah.
Which is kind of what people have been led to believe, It's like the separation of church and state,
Yeah.
The state can bomb people and the Christians can talk about how much they love each other. it's just so terrible. All the wars going on in this planet. It's like we're in one of those periods of the periodic psychoses of humankind. You likely, Jim, have heard people talking about like, is there this other planet or comet or sun or something supposed to be coming into our solar system? Have you heard discussion of that very much?
Yeah.
There's different sources. I've not really pursued it a lot. I'm not sure. Some people think it's like the sun, counterpart sun to our sun, and other people it's a planet, and other people a comet, or brown dwarf star. I'm not sure. There's different kind of theories and ideas about it. It's interesting, in my new book on the slugs, on Beelzebub's tales to his grandson, there's one thing that I have to add to that book, which is Gurdjieff's description of how every now and then there are these irregular comets that come into our solar system and cause disruption, which he says can lead to war and or this kind of need for the awakening of humankind. This is actually in Beelzebub's tales, and I haven't quite grasped it well enough. It's going to be in the next edited edition of The Slugs. I'm going to bring that in. He has a special name for the process. It's SOL, soul.
Oh, yeah. I know what you're talking about, yeah.
But it was funny rereading that lately, and I thought, oh, that's what everybody's saying about this kind of irregular comet or planet coming into our system. And in a way, Gurdjieff talked about that. I was shocked a little bit. I got to go back and reread it and get more clearly, get it down a bit more exactly. Anyway, that was an aside a bit. So we were kind of talking a little bit about mysticism and science, and we were kind of ranging across the universe a little bit. Another thing, just going back, we were talking about like the formation of subtle body fields underlying the body, and how these, like Burr, you mentioned, called them L fields or life fields. And it seems that, like, given the enigmas of modern biology, how people are unable to explain the development of the morphology of the body, you need to postulate these kinds of underlying fields. But anyway, I wanted to mention, I so like the Kabbalistic image of what they call the ladder of Jacob. And what this image is it's a series of four trees of life strung together, one below the other, which gives you kind of like a hierarchy of kind of levels of existence. And it's called Jacob's Ladder. And in Kabbalah, there are said to be four worlds generated. The first world is the world of emanation. The second world is said to be the world of creation. And the world of creation is the spiritual world. And then is said to come the world of formation. And the world of formation is the astral world. And then finally you have the world made, which is the physical world. So in Kabbalah, what you have is you have this world of formation, which underlies the physical bodies. So you have that in Kabbalah, is you have this underlying field. I think it's a very useful term, formation, because it's like in Kabbalah, it's like the intelligence of the design comes from the spiritual world, but that it's the world of formation that forms the template underlying the processes of the body. I'm not sure why I very much like that model of Kabbalah, the four planes of existence: emanation, creation, formation, and the world made. And I think that's very valuable. And it's, I say that applies to the human heart. So the level of the emanation is a God spark. And then the world of creation is your spiritual self. And that's connected to the spiritual heart center. And then the world of formation is like the body template and the astral body, the world of formation that underlies the material body or the material heart. So it's like you have the divine source element, a spiritual heart, a psychical heart center, and then a physical heart. And you see in those cases, Jim, where there are heart transplants, and people get the heart of somebody else, and then they have emotions and psychical impressions connected to the donor's life. And I think what that shows you is the psychical nature of the heart. And there's memory of the emotions and feelings in the psychical level of the heart. And when the person acquires a new heart, those energies are still embodied in part in that heart.
Yeah, very interesting. I've been told that that happens with other organ transplants, too.
Yes, I've heard that, too. I've heard that of kidney and
yeah,
kidney
yeah,
transplants
yeah.
affecting people's food preferences and things like that. Because...
Which makes
I think
sense.
you could say there's a form of memory likely yeah. associated with each organ system.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they're all part of a living system.
Yeah.
So there's
well, in each and alchemical and metaphysical systems, that's basically what there was. Eh? It's like things were, you know, the humors were associated with the organs, and then they have all the schemes are trying to suggest that the different organs did have these different functions and sort of metaphysical elements to them that were individuated and they weren't just like these, you know, different physical structures, but they actually had different psychic and alchemical qualities too.
Yeah, and even related to the different glands and the planets and elements
exactly.
A complex kind of science of, I think they call it correspondences.
Right.
Yeah,
that is the word, yeah. Listen to this, just apropos for sort of what I was, remember I was talking about what I was trying to represent what Wheeler said, and I just found this is from Mysticism and the New Physics by Michael Talbot, and he's talking about... talking about Wheeler's work, but all along the physicist has searched for the ultimate substance of matter and viewed empty space as simply the stage of the material world. Atomic particles were conceived of as being something quite different from this empty stage. But as Whitaker suggests, this is another science, with the advent of the new physics, the stage itself becomes one of the actors. The wave-particle duality of matter is our first hint that matter and so-called empty space are much more intimately related. As Wheeler stated, quote, is space-time only an arena within which the fields and particles move about as physical, quote-unquote, and foreign, quote-unquote, entities? Or is the four-dimensional continuum all there is? Is curved empty geometry a kind of magic building material out of which everything in the physical world is made? One, slow curvature in one region of space describes a gravitational field. Two, a ripple geometry within a different type of curvature somewhere else describes an electromagnetic field. Three, a knotted up region of high curvature describes a concentration of charge and mass energy that moves like a particle. Are fields and particles foreign entities immersed in geometry, or are they nothing but geometry?
Yeah, well...
Yeah, and again, you know, I mean, these are big questions, like, sort of, where, I mean, certainly beyond my measly little brain, but, I mean, it's interesting that what he's suggesting, I'm trying to relate it to what Blavatsky's saying, and I think it kind of leads to this idea that, oh, you know, there is something in the actual geometry of space, and I know that, you know, that's a big topic for you, is like what she says about the nature of space, but it sort of, like it deepens the mysteries, and it certainly suggests that what she's saying is like, you know, could be right and may actually be the key to understanding of some of these things, some of these huge mysteries, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting also, like... Kind of go back to the holographic model that's coming out in physics, and how there, oh, it's so hard to explain this. They have this concept of what they call anti-de Sitter space. And anti-de Sitter space is like hyperspace, but whereas four-dimensional space-time is curving, can curve more or less, de Sitter space looks the same at all time. So it's constant. So in a way, it's like, yeah, it's like hyperspace. I'm not sure what I'm trying to suggest.
What is hyperspace?
Well, what I'm trying to suggest is that it doesn't curve in the same ways as four-dimensional space-time. It's more constant.
Okay.
It's beyond the level of four-dimensional space-time.
What is the significance of that for?
In the holographic paradigm, it's how this black hole activity in this higher dimensional space is rendered equivalent to expanding, contracting universes in four-dimensional space.
Oh, that's kind of interesting.
I can't quite get my mind around what I'm trying to express about it. It's so useful to have those pictures that are illustrated in some of my articles.
Yeah, I was
on that.
The illustrations are very nice in the article. They're quite striking. Even with the diagrams, it's hard to kind of like for people to unless you have a physics background or like you know, it's like I don't know. It's very difficult to understand all this. Oh, I just realized I'm outside. I forgot my neighbors are having a party tonight.
Oh.
Yeah, they're moving to New Zealand, so.
Are they really?
Yes, she's from New Zealand originally, and they're going there for a year, so.
Wow, nice.
And I'm sitting in my backyard because it's nice being able to do a show and sit outside in the back. It's a glorious day in Toronto today, so.
Oh, yes, nice here, too.
Yeah.
And we don't even have chemtrails today.
Oh,
it's funny
nice.
How you have some days. We had one day this week, we woke up in a nice clear sky, and they're chemtrailing all through the day, and by the end of the day, the whole sky's got all these, they're chemtrail clouds. They're all unnatural clouds. And then another day is like, oh, real clouds again. And you got a blue sky and real cumulus clouds. I watch the chemtrails quite actively. It still shocks me, and it's amazing how people are so unaware of it. But really, how it's gone on for so long? The chemtrail spraying has gone on for 15 years now through all the NATO countries, and I don't think so much in third world countries. When I was in New Zealand, I only saw them like once or twice in New Zealand over a 5-month period. Whereas here in Ottawa, we get quite heavily sprayed at least twice a week, I would say.
We
still have half hour left. I meant to direct people to my website at www.zeropoint.ca, and I put some of the newest edition of the slugs up there because I redid the material on Gurdjieff's views on the causes of war and special societies and things like that. So there's some good material from Beelzebub's Tales up on my website. If you follow the go to the table of contents from the slugs book. And the other thing, I did want to mention, before our next show, I have two guest appearances coming up on Don Nikoloff again, and that's on next Tuesday night, the 12th, but Don's show's at 1 o'clock in the morning Eastern, so the 12th is really, it's the 13th in my time zone. But that's at 1 o'clock at night on Evident Footprints through BBS. And then I'm also on Don's show again on the 21st of this month. It was very interesting last time on Don's show, Jim. Like, we talked about, like, spirituality and spiritual teachings and consciousness, but relate it more to the world situation. And last show I did with Don, it was very interesting because he was reading about all the Hasnamasas. And he wanted to go through I forget the Gurdjieff term, but the spectrum of impulses, where Gurdjieff says that these are the seven spectrum of impulses for Hasnamasas. So we were going through those, that spectrum of impulses. It was quite funny. Okay, so just a couple notes. And I would encourage people, I think these four books that I've produced are really very valuable. The Heart Doctrine, the God Science and the Secret Doctrine, which is on creation physics, and then the two books on Gurdjieff. They're very valuable books. They're all available through Amazon, so you can get them anywhere in North America. If you put Christopher P. Holmes into Amazon, you'll come upon the page with the four books available. Or people can write to me. They can send money through PayPal and order through me directly if they would rather do that. And I'll sign the books if anyone wants to order anything from me. And I also want to mention, I have available, I'm producing it now, Jim, as a two-part DVD set. And one of the DVDs is our BBS shows from the beginning. So it's got 5 years of our BBS shows, which is 50 hours a year. So it's over 250 hours of show. Oh, my God. That's what we'll have to listen to in hell. Okay, now you got to listen to yourself for 250 hours.
I was going to say, are you actually going to charge people money for that? it's funny because when it was late, the show was 2 or 3 years old. I really had wanted to go back because we were archived and wanted to go back and sort of select out. There's a lot of repetition. We were all over the place, and a lot of, obviously, in that many hours. But there are some conversations in particular, and I remember like certain shows, and I remember like Karen commenting about certain shows, where I think we really explained things very well, or we had very interesting conversations. There's lots of things in there that I'm sure I would be shocked if I went back and heard us talking and that I wouldn't remember or that we had touched on or made certain connections. I mean, so there's a lot of material. It's like, I don't know if that's, if that's a reward or a punishment for the listener. But it's like, there's just so much good material there that it certainly,
And it's like it's material that you need to hear over and over again to kind of clarify it and get different angles on it.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes, I'll say to someone, my book's about how human consciousness originates out of the heart rather than the mind and the brain and the head. And a person can kind of learn that, and they can have that basic concept. But to really hear it articulated in different ways and the different kinds of evidences and how it's explained in different traditions and, like, there's so much more to it. It's not just, it's not just a superficial idea. Like, it's a very complex teaching that mystics provide about the nature of the human heart. We don't just need to hear it once. We need to hear it dozens of times. And even ourselves, we surprise ourselves expressing things in new ways at different times, And the same thing, we talk about the laws of 3 and 7 and the zero-point concepts. All of those concepts are so profound. And I think if someone listens regularly to the show, over time you learn the language. And the more you do that and grasp the basic concepts, then I think more and more it's accessible to people.
Yeah.
But it's a process. It's like I couldn't possibly explain to anyone in 100 hours like how I really understand and grasp things now. Like, one can't give this knowledge to people. We point the way and work all around it in ways, but people have to take something that we say and come to it themselves in their own inner experience. Because it's one thing to kind of hear us talk about consciousness, but then, you know, it's another thing if a person actually makes the effort to remember themselves that we talk about and studies themselves in the ways that we talk about. Like, you do those things, and then you begin to have experience that deepens your intellectual knowledge. And a person can't, acquiring knowledge, it's not simply enough to acquire intellectual knowledge. You know, Gurdjieff talks about knowledge and understanding, and how knowledge can be intellectual, but to attain understanding, you then have to have experience of things, and that gives you understanding. And I think the same with the materials offered through this show, that it's not that people can listen and acquire that knowledge. It can help them, you know, move towards a different way of conceiving of things. But over time, it has to be transubstantiated in certain ways through their inner experience to deepen those teachings. Like, to me, I know, just as an example, you know, I think that this idea of how consciousness in the material body is connected to the blood flow in the body, I think this is a very profoundly important idea. And I do these demonstrations where I get people to put their hands together and see if they're the same height. And then you put all your attention in one hand, and you put your hand together again, and you see how it expands. One hand gets bigger if you put your consciousness in the hand. And the implication of that is that blood flow is connected to consciousness. So if you put your consciousness in your feet, you warm up your feet, because the blood flows there. So I think there's lots of experiential evidences connecting consciousness to blood flow. So that's a concept that someone can hear it as a concept, but then what you could do is actually, in your own inner experience, try to be aware of the localization of consciousness and to explore it in that way. I mean, that's what I think I saw 40 years ago when I began studying the Gurdjieff teaching, Jim, how he says psychology has to begin with self-study, especially when it comes to the study of the issues of consciousness, because you can never observe anybody else's consciousness. So the only way to study consciousness is in yourself, which is like irrefutable.
Yeah.
Hey, like as a line of reasoning, like you can never observe someone else's consciousness, and you can never observe it by analyzing a brain. You know, the only way to directly study consciousness is within ourselves. And then you realize that Western scientists have made no effort to do that. And I think that's kind of is what underlies much of the kind of false, what I would call as false teaching or false knowledge that's arisen in Western psychology. It's not been rooted into self-study.
Yeah.
And then that's what you find about all the mystics, is that these mystics are people who set out like to know themselves or to find God. And what they report is that what they wake up to is the self within the heart. Like the poet's Rumi, who kind of goes searching for God, and he can't find him in the temple, and he can't find him in the synagogue, and he goes to the highlands and the lowlands, everywhere looking to find God. And then he says, and finally I found him in his only place, within my known heart. So I think, you know, I hope the people who do listen to us regularly make efforts to be working on themselves and try to find the application of these teachings in their day-to-day life. And I hope we give out enough kind of material that helps people at times breach those two different worlds.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different aspects of it, like you say. I mean, we talk about the law of 3 and 7, and I was thinking, like, the idea of consciousness as light, how, you know, we've explored that from so many different angles. I mean, you could actually take that as a theme through those shows and write a small book just on that topic and basis of what we've said. I mean, I think it's very much too late. As you say, when introduced to the Fourth Way teaching, as I remember reading In Search of the Miraculous and by Uspensky, and about Gurdjieff's, which is his meeting with Gurdjieff and Gurdjieff's talks in Russia, and which are incredibly succinct and have this incredible authority, and which is very different from everything in Western psychology. And I mean, I think what you said earlier is that the need for self-study points to sort of the absurdity, the real significant error that Western psychologists have made is that they've tried to equate objectivity with external observation, and it just doesn't work in terms of consciousness. It's like the drunk who's looking for his keys under the porch light because there's more light there. Well, it doesn't work that way.
But that's actually not where he's left his keys.
Yeah, that's not where his keys are at all. It's like, you know, there's more light here. So we'll look for consciousness in other people. But, I mean, it just, you know, it just doesn't work. There's a book by Jacob Needleman who's written, he's a American philosopher, who's written extensively about esotericism and very interesting guy. I like his work. He wrote a book recently called What is God? Oh. It's kind of equates his, it's kind of an account of his journey as a, you know, he began as he was raised in a Jewish home, and he kind of turned his back on the religious teachings and traditions that he was brought up in, but he became a philosophy student, then he became interested in Zen Buddhism and actually met D.T. Suzuki, the great Zen scholar, and then he became interested in the Fourth Way. And he went away from the Fourth Way for a while, but he eventually came back to it. And I just want to read a little bit, because this, I think, relates exactly to what we were talking about listening to these programs, how you can't grasp everything at the same time. But you can hear some of these ideas, and you can realize, I think if you're attuned or receptive to these ideas at all, you can hear things and you can realize, like, wow, there's something important there, but you can't grasp it all at once. And it's like, it's a very interesting process. And he's talking about it, how originally when he read In Search of the Miraculous, it made a really strong impression on him. He says, although many of the ideas in it struck me as outlandish, many others were startling, insightful about ideas about the human psyche, unlike anything I had encountered in the writing of psychologists or what I had seen in teachings of the great spiritual traditions of the world, including Zen Buddhism. I was suspicious of what the book said about the need for an esoteric school based on a knowledge of higher level than anything that could be found in our contemporary world. But while entertaining heavy doubts and suspicions, I was being bombarded on nearly every page by stunning explanations that put in question one after another of my philosophical assumptions and convictions about, so it seemed, nearly everything I believed. The more I read, the more I was troubled. I was both troubled and inwardly moved by the intimation of an invisible and immense coherence of thought behind all that was being said.
Wow.
But the most remarkable thing about the book was what emerged in it about the figure of Gurdjieff himself. The way I put it to myself was that he spoke with authority, and he has with authority italicized, because this is exactly what I felt. This is exactly my reactions to reading In Search of the Miraculous. I won't attempt here to explain or justify that statement beyond saying that it was a feeling. And that feeling itself had a kind of action upon me, a quality of authority that ordinary emotions, even at their most intense, did not have. This sense of inner authority existed within me alongside all of the doubts and questions and convictions that I naturally had as a well-educated, well-trained student of philosophy. This feeling of authority did not, so to say, attempt to overpower or refute all my own ideas and acquired convictions. It just existed, shall I say, radiated, calmly inside my mind, and in some strange way permitted and in some sense contained all my familiar thoughts about God and everything else. It was like discovering not so much new ideas or a new philosophy, but, if I may put it this way, it was like discovering a new part of my mind. And I think that's precisely, I think that's exactly what I experienced, you know. I still marvel every time I read In Search of the Miraculous. I remember my primary reaction to reading that book, and I read it very slowly, was when Gurdjieff made these speeches, I was like, this guy actually knows what he's talking about. And I, you know, I mean, as an intellectual psychology, sociology student, my main forte was probably criticizing other people and poking holes in their ideas and theories. And I just, I read this stuff and I thought, a lot of this is ridiculous. I don't have any clue what he's talking about, but there's so much to it that I'll just suspend my judgment. I know that I don't know. And it kind of, I think the reviewer, it's on the back of In Search of the Miraculous, says it's an amazingly provocative book which calls into question every one of the reader's assumptions about everything. And that's basically it.
Well,
but there's
yeah.
this like this incredible authority in what Gurdjieff was saying. Was like, this guy isn't bullshitting this. He isn't making this
no.
up. And I still see that not only in his work, but in any like real esoteric teaching, I feel that, that there's an inner authority. And I think it's like he says, it sort of falls out on you and makes you, puts you in contact with another part of your mind that, that most of what we take to be knowledge and teaching doesn't touch somehow. It's like, it's very difficult to define it or to explain it. As he said, it's almost like it's just a feeling, but it's a very real feeling. And I think that's a really wonderful quote, because I think that, and I think that applies to what we've been talking about on this program, is like whenever we're really talking about what we know, and, you know, it's not what we know, but what we know of what we've learned from esotericism, I think there's an authenticity to it and there's an authority to it that really is almost palpable at times, and I think people who are sensitive to and receptive to new ideas can probably recognize that or have that feeling also, and it doesn't come to you all at once. It's sort of like a solution in which the picture emerges over time, you know, like all the elements are there, but you have to keep, you know, you have to wait, you have to take time, but it's also like it's an interactive process, because the more you put into it, the more you get out of it, and it's you have to pass beyond the intellectual knowledge of it to the actual practical attempt to apply it to your life and to your understanding of your life and your understanding of others' lives. And the more that you do that, the more you acquire what Gurdjieff calls understanding, and the more that feeds back and you understand, that you get gain a depth of knowledge that you didn't have before. And as I said many times before in this program, it's like with esoteric knowledge, coherence is gained, but comprehension isn't sacrificed. Like it becomes both more coherent, more precise, but at the same time, it also becomes more comprehensive. It's quite amazing. Like, I think that's what distinguishes for me. Intellectually, that's what distinguishes esotericism from all other thought, is that the more I study and know and understand it, the clearer it all becomes to me too. It's like it grows in terms of comprehension, but it also grows in terms of coherence.
Yeah, exactly. And we were lucky we started with Gurdjieff. Even today,
yeah.
I don't think there's any system of esoteric knowledge that's near as imminently practical
yeah.
as the fourth way teaching. And practical, like when we began to study Gurdjieff, we were both graduate students in psychology. So we, you know, we knew what the issues of the day, and we knew the scientific language and so on. And then so immediately, Gurdjieff provided such wholly alternative perspectives on all the central issues. You know, what is consciousness, and how he says, oh, we think we have one mind. We don't realize that really there are these independent minds in us, you know, these independent centers, and how his explanation, how we think we know what I is, but we don't realize that we only know little I. We don't know real I. You know, he kind of begins with a very close attention to language and having a clarifying language, because once you learn the Gurdjieff language, it's amazing. He says anyone who learns this kind of teaching, they can communicate with each other in a very precise way that other people are incapable of communicating. And I think that's definitely true, and we found that early on because we could so easily communicate about what things we were experiencing, like seeing our mechanicalness, how Gurdjieff talks about how we're a machine, and you start observing and seeing how mechanically you do everything without consciousness. Just so many things were... you could confirm them directly through your experiences. And I remember one thing that Gurdjieff said, one teaching, where he distinguishes between essence and personality in a person. And he says, essence in a person, in a way, is what is their own. It's in the structures of their being. It is their self, in a way. Whereas personality, he says, is acquired from outside, from education, conditioning, all these external influences. And he says of this distinction between essence and personality, there's no similar concept in modern psychology. And I think even today, I don't see that anything compatible or comparable to that in modern psychology. But it's such an immensely valuable concept. Yeah.
Yeah, essentially everything about the psychological teaching, and as I say, I think you really touched on something extremely important, is that you acquire this new language and you know, the principle of it is based on the principle of relativity within Gurdjieff's system, is that everything has a distinct sort of place within the system, and everything can be judged in terms of these different levels, and it's a sort of a multidimensional language in a sense, and it provides you a precise way of kind of labeling things and at the same time relating them to other aspects of the teaching, and so it's incredibly coherent. That's what I guess I keep coming back to that word.
Yeah.
But that's what it is. It's coherent, and as psychologists, I mean, that's what was so, I think, interesting to us, is that how can we have studied all these theories of personality and all these different aspects of social and personality psychology and clinical and abnormal, and yet, you know, here's somebody who's saying that, you know, our normal waking consciousness is not what it seems at all, and that you have to understand the psychopathology of the free brain beings of the planet Earth, and details all these things, and you're one of them, by the way. You know, it's like, oh, okay, so study yourself and find out that you know, everything happens to you, and you don't have real life, you don't have real will, and you can't do it. It's like, oh, okay, well, it all seemed pretty clear to me that it was like, you know, it's true, but as you say, I don't think there's any esoteric teaching that I'm familiar with that is accessible and it's very, very practical in terms of trying to live your life in a different way, and it's a very good beginning because it's translated more to be accessible to Westerners and to modern people, and it's kind of what also allows you to practice it without retreating from the world. You can go about your life and be, you know, whatever you are, like as a student or a, you know, an office worker or whatever, a laborer, it doesn't really matter. You can do anything, and yet you can practice this teaching, which is very, very valuable. So,
I think Gurdjieff calls it at one point, doesn't he call it the way of the sly man?
Yeah, yeah.
Because you can kind of, like, be in the world but not of it. Like,
yeah.
You don't have to retreat away to a monastery or devote yourself like that to it, but...
Yeah, I have this kind of ongoing discussion with a friend of mine who's become very interested in Tibetan Buddhism and you know, attends a temple and is actually in Washington to meet the Dalai Lama this
Wow. Time.
Yeah, yeah. And he talks about retreating, you know, and he's a lawyer and he's like the world, like the samsara and of the world and all of the suffering and everything, and it's like the attachment of having a family and all the obligations. But I said to him, you know, it's like Gurdjieff's perspective on it, I think is very interesting and very valuable. It's like, what's the value of retreating and living in a cave for 10 years to become enlightened, and then you come out and the first person that steps on your corns, which is a Gurdjieff expression for annoys you in any way, you want to kill them, you know, it's difficult. There's certainly retreating is valuable at different parts in your life. I think that's probably very, very valuable. But also, we live in the world. You know, we don't live in caves, and we have to deal with other human beings. That's a part I really like, and I think is very valuable. Much more kind of attracted to that spiritually. Like, I think you should be able to live in the world and deal with people. It's like he said, it's a very big thing to be able to bear the unpleasant manifestations of others is a very huge achievement, you know, and that's so true.
He'd call that conscious or intentional suffering.
Yes.
At times he uses that phrase as part.
Yeah.
That's part of that bearing the unconscious manifestations of others.
Yeah.
Okay, so I know we just got a couple minutes left, Jim, so we'll be back in 2 weeks' time. I'm looking forward to getting that book. I may be down to Toronto within the next couple of weeks, but I want to read that and send that fellow a copy of my writing. And
now that we have mail service again, I'll send it to you.
Things were behind.
A week or so behind. And it was funny because it was a chance that I might be going to Amsterdam in September, and I was thinking,
oh,
this guy up. Yeah, I don't know if that's going to happen, but. My nephew goes to conferences all the time, and the rooms are paid for, and he has all these frequent flyer points. So he said, you know, you could come with me and just stay, you know, while I go. He's working at these conferences. So he said,
wow, nice.
Yeah. So he wasn't sure about Amsterdam. I was actually invited to go to San Diego in December, but I can't make it. But he said, you know, there'll still be trips. So I was really thinking, gee, I've never been to Amsterdam, so I'd like to do that. But also,
wow, that would be exciting.
Yeah, I thought if I could do it, I'd actually try to contact Dr. Van Lommel. I really love this book. I think it's a very important book. I think you'll be excited by it. Yeah.
Well, we'll cover it more in a future show. We'll devote a show to it.
Yeah.
The quote you quoted today from it was just excellent.
I think it'd be very interesting.
Great. Okay. So we'll see you in 2 weeks. And thank you, BBS Radio. And I encourage people to go to www.zeropoint.ca. Okay. Thank you all. And remember yourself. Keep heart. Goodbye.